November the 13th, 1977, Los Angeles, California. Schoolgirls Dolores and Sonia were on their way home from a day's shopping when two police officers stopped them for questioning. But the so-called policemen were in fact killers.
They fell victim to two men who knew no compassion, no remorse, no empathy. It is beyond depraved.
14-year-old Sonia and 12-year-old Dolores were abducted, held captive for 5 days, repeatedly raped, then strangled. Their killers were two cousins, Angelo Bono and Kenneth Bianchi.
You got the smooth-talking, sharp, glib Bianchi. And then you've got the street con, wise, smart predator in Bono. That's a pretty dangerous combination.
The partners in crime went on a killing spree, murdering 10 young women in just 4 months. Many were dumped on hillsides across LA, lending the killers their infamous name, the Hillside Stranglers.
These two were not going to stop until they were caught. This had a really devastating effect on the lives of women in Los Angeles.
The deadly duo terrorized the streets of LA whilst masquerading as police officers. They raped and tortured victims as young as 12 during their sickening rampage, making Angelo Bono and Kenneth Bianchi two of the world's most evil killers. December 14th, 1977, Los Angeles, California. On a deserted hillside overlooking the city, 17-year-old Kimberly Martin was found dead by two paperboys doing their morning rounds. Her killers had posed her body in a provocative manner.
They dropped her naked body on the hills in Alisanto Drive, pointing at the City Hall. I think that was a deliberate placement to kind of piss everybody off, you know. Now, the media kind of went crazy about this. That's where the name Hillside Strangler came from.
Kimberly was the ninth victim of the killers in barely 2 months. It became one of the biggest news stories of the year, spreading panic throughout the city.
It created a whole lot of fear, particularly amongst women who were actually afraid to go out at night. And there was some indication from some of the investigation that whoever was perpetrating these crimes may have been impersonating a police officer. Women were concerned that if they were approached by police officers, should they stop or should they just keep moving? It was really a terrorizing period of time.
In response, firearm sales went through the roof, and the women of L.A. made preparations to defend themselves.
Women were taking physical defense lessons, buying guns, getting stuff to prevent themselves on the street to keep from being assaulted. They're reading about it every day. It's on television every day. That's a lot of panic out there in the street, and you could sense it in the street. You really could.
I think that gave Bianchi and Bono pleasure. I think they took an absolute delight in the fact that they had taken a whole community by the throat, literally, and strangled the life out of it.
The story of these two killers begins in Rochester, New York. Angelo Bono was the eldest of the adoptive cousins and was born on October 5th, 1934. He and his sister were born into an Italian-American family. At the age of 5, his parents divorced, and in 1939, his mother took her two children west to Glendale in Los Angeles.
You could say that Bono was a troubled child. He had a very strange relationship with his mother, whom he constantly accused of being a whore.
Now, he doesn't speak very highly of his mother at all. His mother would go and visit men and he would have to wait outside. So here's an individual who's got very fixed ideas about who women are and how they should behave and what's acceptable for women and what isn't. And I think that feeds into the rationale behind the future offending.
At the age of 16, Bono dropped out of high school and turned to crime.
As a teenager, Bono was somebody who regularly broke the rules. He would steal things, he would joyride in cars, he would hang around with gangs. This is somebody who just did not think the rules applied to him. And when you look at who his role models are, they were criminals. So he's starting off on a very dangerous path.
Whilst Bono was serving time in youth custody for stealing cars in 1951, his adoptive cousin, Kenneth Alessio Bianchi, was born on the 22nd of May. He too had a troubled start in life.
Kenneth Bianchi, born, funnily enough, also in Rochester, New York, just like Bono. But Bianchi's mother was a sex worker, and he was very swiftly put up for adoption as a three-month-old infant. And he was adopted by Bono's mother's sister.
He's adopted by Frances and Nicholas. Now, Frances absolutely doted on him, but she took this to an absolute extreme, and she had this paranoia that there was something wrong with Kenneth, and she took him to see the doctor on multiple occasions when there turned out to be absolutely nothing wrong with him. And I think this kind of smothering can be just as damaging as neglect. There was something quite toxic going on here.
Soon, the young Bianchi started showing worrying signs of behaviour.
He was described by his adopted mother as a compulsive liar from a very, very early age. He was difficult to control. And then his father dies when he's a teenager. So the male role model is removed, and he is, to some extent, left swinging in the breeze.
Despite being just 14, Bianchi's mother had big plans for the son she'd sheltered. At the funeral, she made Bianchi wear his father's shoes. They were far too big and he walked clumsily. But they were a symbol of who he had become, the man of the house.
They were an Italian Catholic family with some very rigid ideas about family and about the role of men and the role of women. So we're seeing some quite strong values coming through in his childhood, and they're values that he draws on in an incredibly dysfunctional way.
His mother recognized that he had a lot of psychiatric issues and problems, and she wouldn't let him date girls. She watched over him very, very closely.
Bianchi graduated high school and, aged 18, married his sweetheart, Brenda. But his insecurities about her forging her own career as a nurse caused tension in the marriage.
Bianchi saw women as something to be possessed. They could be his and his alone. The marriage to Brenda fell apart very quickly. He was only 18. He accused her of being unfaithful. It played to his sense that any woman he had to possess, he had to control completely.
After just a few months, the couple divorced. Bianchi then planned a respectable career in the police. In 1970, he enrolled in college to study police science and psychology.
He was absolutely obsessed with becoming a police officer. He applied to join the police several times and failed at doing that. This was a fixation for him throughout his life. I think failing was one of the factors in the background of who he became. He wants that legitimate control. He wants that legitimate power. And if he can't get it legitimately, he's going to get it by some other means.
After failing to get his dream job as a police officer, Bianchi found work as a security guard. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, his cousin Bono was a career car thief. By this point in 1970, the 36-year-old had been married and divorced twice and fathered eight children by three different women.
A lot of women said that he had a very sexual, strong feeling about him, but it was a scary, frightening kind of thing. It was kind of a predator kind of a thing. And he had been through a whole lot of women. was very sexually active. And he was proud of that reputation.
Buono's attitude to women and to the women he married was abusive. There can be no doubt about that. And each of them described his abusiveness, his drama, threatened with a gun, persistently kicked, brutalized.
He was very aggressive sexually, even with young, young girls.
There was something in Buono which saw women as objects. Man who saw women as something of his right.
Before long, the two maternal cousins, who barely knew each other, would discover they shared the same intense loathing of women. Buono and Bianchi would move in together and become partners in crime. Soon, this dangerous team would be heading on a path towards murder. By 1975, 41-year-old Angelo Buono had served three short prison terms for stealing cars. He also had a long, dark history of domestic abuse, raping and beating former wives and girlfriends. But now it seemed Buono wanted to settle on the straight and narrow.
Although he wasn't particularly well-educated, he was quite smart. He was capable of running a business. Indeed, he started his own business, auto upholstery.
It was very successful. Matter of fact, the rumor is he did one of Frank Sinatra's cars. He also considered himself a mafia kind of guy.
At home and at work, Buono was meticulous to the extreme.
Buono was obsessed with cleanliness. He would bleach his house several times a week. He was able to change the brakes on a car without getting dirty. When you see people who are obsessed with cleanliness, it's about feeling that everything is within your control.
Meanwhile, over 2,500 miles away in Rochester, New York, Bono's cousin, Ken Bianchi, had been fired from his job as a security guard for stealing jewellery at the department store where he was working. In January 1976, Bianchi's family came up with a plan to temper the wayward 24-year-old.
Their mothers are sisters, and they think it's a good idea for these two to live together. And I think it is part of those kind of Italian Mediterranean family values, you know, that if you're part of a family, then you're always welcome. You should always look out for one another.
Buono was doing the family a favor, taking him in. This is something he didn't really want to do. This is a guy who lives alone. And to take in a boarder was something that, he wasn't happy with.
Bianchi apparently looked up to Angelo Buono, his older cousin, kind of admired the tough guy image that he projected.
Once again, Bianchi tried for a career in the police, this time with the LAPD. But once again, he failed his exams. In the end, Bianchi resorted to lies to get a respectable job.
He had phony certificates made up, showing that he was a graduate of Columbia University and had a degree in psychiatry, and he was actually a psychologist. A psychologist in Los Angeles actually hired this guy, and he was seeing his patients. He had a gift of really selling himself, and he did. He was a sociopath, and he was a pathological liar.
In June 1976, Bianchi finally made it into the LAPD reserves as an unpaid volunteer. He also found himself a desk job to pay the bills. And at work, he met a new girlfriend whom he moved in with. By now, the cousins had a real rapport. Bianchi looked up to the older Buono and was only too quick to get involved when he suggested they establish themselves as pimps.
He and Buono set up what only could be described as an agency for prostitutes. They target two young women whom they set up to work for them, to make them money as sex workers.
It was a marriage made in hell. I mean, here you've got a sexual predator and a sociopath. Bianchi wants to be like his cousin Angelo. See, he looks up to him, he's older. He was excited that it's a recipe for madness.
but pimping prostitutes wasn't enough for them. To satisfy their own sexual cravings, they prowled the streets using a tactic inspired by an infamous criminal from the 1940s.
When Buono was an adolescent, he very much looked up to career criminals, and one particular criminal, a serial rapist called Chessman, who he became very interested in, had actually used a police ruse in order to target his victim. I think Buono saw something there that lodged in his mind, and that would later come out in his defending.
Angelo Buono had a security badge that belonged to his stepfather. And they used that to portray themselves as undercover police officers. They started using the badge to get free sex from prostitutes. They liked the fact that they could get girls back to their house and have them have sex with them, then play a badge on them and tell them that, hey, don't tell anybody we did this or you'll be in trouble.
But the excitement of duping women for free casual sex soon wore off. Buono and Bianchi wanted to up the stakes, to indulge a depraved desire.
They both agreed, why don't we try choking somebody to death while we're having an orgasm? That would be something I'd like to do. That was Buono's thing. And of course, whatever Buono said, Bianchi went along with.
It's what the psychologists call folie à deux. One adds depth to the other. One eggs the other one on. One's the sorcerer and the other one's the apprentice, and then suddenly they become partners in crime.
At 11 p.m. on the 17th of October 1977, Buono and Bianchi were cruising down one of Hollywood's most famous streets, Sunset Boulevard. They had their fake police badges at the ready.
Bianchi had a four-door sedan that could resemble a police car at night. It had no siren or lights, but it had the same color, dark blue and a white top. They used that car in all the stops and pullovers that they made.
Here they spotted 19-year-old Yolanda Washington.
She was a mum, she was struggling to make ends meet. She became involved in sex work, and they picked her up, claiming to be police officers.
Got her in a car under the pretense of who they were, and Bianchi strangled her in the backseat. And that's where it started.
They dumped Yolanda's body on Forest Lawn Drive, not far from Glendale. She was discovered early the next morning.
She had a 3-year-old child, and she's treated as a piece of garbage.
From there, it just kind of accelerated. They started discussing what they were going to do. Let's take them back to the house. If we take them back to the house, then we can play games with them. And that's exactly what they did.
Barely 2 weeks later, on the night of the 30th of October, Buono and police reservist Bianchi were roaming the streets once again. As they stalked Sunset Boulevard, a young girl caught their eye.
Judy Miller was picked up on Sunset Boulevard near a hot dog stand.
Judy was 15 years old, so a few years younger than Yolanda Washington, and she's been described as a runaway, but she's a child, she's incredibly vulnerable, and I think they recognise that, and they prey upon that vulnerability again.
The killers lured Judy into their car under the pretense of hiring her for sex. Once inside, they pulled out their fake badges. She was trapped, and this time Buono and Bianchi had even more sinister plans.
They took her to Buono's auto upholstery shop, where she was systematically raped.
This change in offending is really significant for me, because when you're taking your victims to somewhere that's private, an environment over which you have control, this suggests that you want to escalate your offending. You want to spend more time with your victims. You want to harm them more.
Using a ligature placed around her neck, they strangled 15-year-old Judy. Then the killer cousins dumped her naked body in bushes off a quiet residential street in the neighborhood of La Crescenta. When she was found the next day, detectives noted the lack of drag marks on her body.
That gave us a kind of an indication that there might have been two guys, because If you have a dead body and you're lugging it around, you want to put it place here and place there, it's very difficult. And if you do that, you usually will have leave marks on the body if you're dragging the heels. But she was placed in an area, and that's where her body was found.
There was a fiber on her eyelid that was visible, and obviously she was blindfolded, which left the fiber.
But despite the police's hunch that there might be two killers working together, there was little else left at the crime scene in the way of clues to help them identify the murderers. Bono and Bianchi felt unstoppable, and on the 5th of November, they decided to target a different type of victim.
Now you have a complete change of pace. It wasn't only directed at sex workers. Lisa Kaslin was a perfectly ordinary, upright girl, 21. She was a dancer, quite a good career, with an extraordinary group called the LA Knockers.
Lisa Kaslin was walking to her apartment, and police ruse was used with her. She was brought back to Bono's shop, you know, raped and murdered, and her body was found in the bushes off a street in Glendale.
Now Bono and Bianchi had killed three young women. They were reveling in their success and growing in confidence. They were getting into their stride.
They would discuss it, according to Kenneth Bianchi. They would sit down, well, what do you want to do tonight? Let's try Hollywood again. Let's pick up another whore in Hollywood. They took him to Bono's upholstery shop and sexually assaulted him, strangled him, took their nude body and threw him in the hillside around the city of Los Angeles. It was a game.
The rampage continued. Just 4 days later, on the 9th of November, 28-year-old actress and model Jane King was stopped at a Hollywood bus bench. She was taken to Bono's workshop, where she was raped, strangled, then dumped next to the freeway in Glendale. The killer cousins had claimed four victims in nearly as many weeks.
It was the most extraordinary spree. And I think one of the things that made them, in the end, terrify Los Angeles, there was no pattern. They literally, like lightning strikes, they had an appetite. And that appetite knew no bounds.
But Bono and Bianchi's killing spree had barely just begun, and soon they'd become the talk of Tinseltown. On Sunday, the 13th of November, they set their sights on two children. Sonia Johnson and Dolores Cepeda were spotted getting on a bus after a Sunday afternoon shopping.
They get off the bus, almost certainly. They're impressionable, they're 12 and 14. Two men stop them, they say they're police officers, they get them into the car, they take them back to Bono's. I mean, it is unimaginable.
This time, the victims were imprisoned and held captive in Bono's home. The two schoolgirls were gagged and bound, then repeatedly raped over 5 days.
What they must have subjected them to, and what those girls must have felt, is literally horrifying. Depravity is too good a word for it. It is utter depravity.
At the end of their torture, the two children were strangled. The killers dumped their bodies 4 miles from Bono's home on a hillside near the famous LA Dodgers Stadium.
It's a street that Bono referred to, and since he had grown up in the area, as the cow patch. And apparently their bodies were just thrown down the hill.
It is behavior of the most disgraceful because it's inhuman. It is animalistic.
Despite raping and killing six women and girls in barely a month, Bianchi and Bono were left wanting for more.
They're varying their offending at this point in time. And offenders will do this because they will get bored. They will want to mix things up. They will want to make things interesting.
Their victims were no longer just randomly picked off the streets. On the 20th of November, 2 days after their last killing, Bianchi called at the home of 20-year-old art student Christina Weckler.
Christina Weckler had met Kenny Bianchi. They lived near each other. He succeeded in getting her out of her apartment on a ruse that he was now an L.A. police officer, and her car was involved in an accident. Why the poor girl went, I don't know, but that was it. They abducted her, took her back to Bono's house.
Once at Bono's home, the killers had devised a new, sickening act of torture for their seventh victim.
They use a more elaborate method of killing her. Not simple manual strangulation, but they put a plastic bag over her head and put a gas pipe into it and effectively suffocate her.
The killers also injected Christina's arms and neck with air and cleaning solutions to try and induce a fatal embolism.
There was a mark on her neck where they put cleaning fluid in her neck with the syringe.
This is incredibly sadistic. It's incredibly drawn out. It is an escalation in their offending. They're enjoying the process of watching their victims die, of having that ultimate power and control over their life and death. And this is something that's only going to get worse.
Then they dumped Christina's body on another remote hillside in Highland Park, several miles from Bono's Glendale home.
It was a Sunday. I was notified at home. They said, we got a dead girl out here, and then it's definitely a murder victim. So I went out, did my usual crime scene investigation, and I noted the ligature marks on the hands and on the ankles.
Detectives also noticed that the bodies continued to be placed and not dragged to each location. They were still convinced that they had more than one killer on the loose.
We had put a lot of uniformed policemen in the area of Northeast Los Angeles looking for two suspects, or one suspect as a serial murderer. So we were focusing in the area where the girls were originally abducted. I think that information got out somehow through the media. So what did Bianchi and Bono do? They drove all the way out to the valley to look for their next victim, 25 miles away.
On the 28th of November, 8 days after their last killing, Bianchi and Bono were cruising the streets of the San Fernando Valley. They spotted 18-year-old business student Lauren Wagner driving home.
They followed her, and she parked right across the street from where she lived. They stopped her, pretended they were police officers, and said they would have to take her in a car, and she resisted. She kind of vocally resisted. And they got her in a car and took her to Bono's house.
Lauren was bound to a chair and gagged in Bono's home. This time, the cousins thought they'd experiment with a different type of torture.
They took wires, plugged them into the wall, kind of pulled the wires apart, and taped the wire to the girl's hand and then plugged it in to electrocute her. There were burn marks in her hands from the wires.
Lauren's body was dumped once again on one of the city's hillsides. Her parents had noticed their daughter's absence and were concerned when they found her abandoned car with the keys left in the ignition.
And this was something that was out of the ordinary. She wouldn't normally do that. So immediately, they knew that something was wrong. They knew something was amiss. So they contacted the local police department.
She was discovered the next day on the 29th of November.
Her body was found once again on the side of a hill on a little street in the Glendale, L.A. area. And she was lying there naked as the others with ants crawling all over her body.
Upon seeing her, we knew right away that she and Christina Weckler were killed by the same people. Both had very similar ligature marks on the body, around the neck, and one on each wrist, and one on each ankle. We began referring to that as five-point ligatures.
Forensic investigators also found a small fiber stuck to the adhesive left by the tape that had been used to attach the electrical wires to Lauren's hand. Detective Bob Grogan went to her parents' home to break the devastating news about their daughter. But word of an eighth strangling victim had got out, which meant the LA press were already one step ahead.
On the street where the Wagners lived was all the media in Los Angeles trying to interview Mr. and Mrs. Wagner. I hadn't even notified them. And they were running around with their microphones looking for an interview. And I ordered the uniformed police to move them off the street and get them out of there. If they turned this into a circus, and this was far from a circus.
The press now had a name for the serial murderer, the Hillside Strangler. But a neighbor had some important information for police which confirmed their earlier suspicions.
She came out and saw two guys putting a girl in a car. That was the first time we actually had visible proof that there were two suspects. Couldn't identify them, but two were seen.
With the killings making daily news in LA, the police were now under pressure to step up their investigation.
After the murder of Lauren Wagner, the detectives, we got together and said, we got a serial murder. We got a big problem. Big problem. The chief wanted a task force. The media wanted a task force. So we got a task force. We got 100 policemen.
But Bono and Bianchi were already planning their next killing and another change of tactic.
They enjoyed the feelings of power and control that killing gave them, but they didn't want to have to go to the effort of going out. They wanted to make it easier for themselves. And going out, actually, was quite a risky thing at this time because this was a ruse that they'd used several times. So it was a combination of awareness of risk and laziness on their part.
Bianchi has found a flat, another apartment in the block he lives in, which is vacant.
On December the 13th, Bianchi called an escort service posing as a client. 17-year-old Kimberly Martin was sent to the empty apartment.
As soon as the door was opened, she knew she had made a mistake. Bono and Bianchi were there and a struggle broke out.
She had quite a severe head injury, almost as if she'd been bashed against a wall. So what I see in this case is an individual who knew that they were in danger and actually fought tooth and nail for their life. And I think that's testament to the strength of character of this individual.
Bono and Bianchi took Kimberly back to Bono's workshop. After raping and strangling her, the killers planned a final act to taunt the city.
Her body was deposited on the side of a hill, kind of overlooking the city of Los Angeles, and her body was kind of displayed like this, and she actually came to symbolize the Hillside Strangler, where she was thrown, was kind of a way for these guys to thumb their nose at the world.
And the media jumped on that, oh, the Hillside Strangler strikes again. So it was a panic situation in the city of LA, no question about it.
The Hillside Stranglers had now claimed 9 innocent lives. Bono and Bianchi sat back and relished how their murders had become one of the biggest news stories ever in LA. The Los Angeles Police Department were now under pressure to catch the killers before they struck again. By December 1977, the Hillside Stranglers had claimed 9 innocent lives. Bono and Bianchi sat back and relished how their murders had become one of the biggest news stories ever in LA. The Los Angeles Police Department were now under pressure to catch the killers before they struck again.
It created an utter panic. If you were young and a young woman in Los Angeles at that time, I think you would have been frightened. Anybody would have been.
Bianchi was reveling with the headlines his murders were generating. Still a member of the LAPD reserves, he went on ride-alongs with the police and was on patrol with a local sergeant just 2 days after Kimberly Martin's killing.
He was asking questions about this murder and he was wanting to see the dump site. So he was trying to find out what the police knew, essentially, is trying to get some information.
And the sergeant said, hey, I work uniform. I don't know anything about that. So he was brazen enough to come out and make that kind of a statement. He told many people, I could be the Hillside Strangler. It didn't bother him, but you got to remember, you're dealing with a pathological liar, so he could say anything at any given moment.
The two murderers decided to lay low for the next 2 months. But on the 16th of February 1978, they couldn't resist 20-year-old Cindy Lee Hudspeth.
She walked into Bono's shop to get upholstery work in her car. Big mistake. The predator of predators she's talking to and doesn't know this. Next thing you know, she's victim 10.
They put her body in the trunk of her Datsun, her orange Datsun car, and they drive it to a higher area of Los Angeles.
The car with her body in it was pushed off of Los Angeles Crest Highway, where she was found.
But soon cracks began to show between the deadly duo. The status that Bianchi was enjoying as a serial killer seemed to be going to the younger cousin's head.
Kenny Bianchi has got to the point where he's kind of got Bono worried because he's bragging about these murders now. Hey, I went a ride along with the police department. Bono couldn't believe that. So there was a falling out. Bono threw him out of the house. He's out, I don't want to see you ever again.
The two killers finally went their separate ways. That same month, Bianchi settled down to become a father when his girlfriend gave birth to their son.
Now you have one of those wonderful contradictions. You have a superficially doting father who has evil intent, who presents, to use the contemporary phrase, as an upright member of the community, and yet is anything but.
In May 1978, Bianchi's girlfriend left him and moved to Bellingham in Washington State. Desperate to stay with his son, Bianchi followed and found a job as a security guard.
We've had this epidemic of killing, and it stops. But the trouble is, Bianchi can't stop. It has become too addictive.
On the 11th of January 1979, Bianchi offered to pay two university students, 22-year-old Karen Mandick and 27-year-old Diane Wilder, $100 to house-sit one of the properties that he was guarding.
It's unclear exactly how Bianchi forced these two down the stairs into the basement, but there's no doubt that he did. He also put a noose around their necks and then strangled them.
Kills the two girls. And he does it on his own. He does it poorly. He masturbated on one of the victims. And he couldn't get it on, couldn't function. He's now acting alone. He doesn't have the street smart, con-wise Angelo Bono as a partner.
Next day, on the 12th of January, Karen's car was found nearby by the police with their bodies hidden in the trunk. Bianchi's employer revealed his whereabouts and he was arrested.
He claims that the killing wasn't done by him, but done by his second personality, Steve Walker. So he's claiming that he has another individual in his head who's telling him to do particular things.
When the police in Bellingham realized their suspect had a Californian driver's license, they contacted the LAPD. Detectives there noticed something interesting on Bianchi's driver's license.
Whenever you moved in California, you had to write on the back of your driver's license your new address. Bianchi diligently did that. He put his address when he moved, which was on the same street that Christina Weckler lived on. That's a pretty strong connection. You got a guy who just killed two girls in Bellingham who used to live next door to a girl in Los Angeles who got killed. That in itself is a strong connection. Doesn't prove anything, but it makes it worthwhile to go talk to that guy. Now, there's a lot of things happening at that time. Bianchi is claiming to be a dual personality, and he's decided that this is going to be my defense.
So one of America's leading criminal psychiatrists was sent to test Bianchi's alter ego, Steve, who allegedly appeared when he was under hypnosis.
Dr. Martin Orme examined Kenneth Bianchi and had some techniques and tricks that he used and came to us and said, this guy's a complete fraud.
Now Bianchi's lies had been exposed. He turned on his partner in crime.
He says there's another person with him on the murders, and it's his cousin Angelo. And it's the first we heard of Angelo.
This is incredibly revealing because there's no sense of loyalty whatsoever here. He's got what he wanted out of Buono, so he just casts him aside and places the blame squarely on him.
In order to get him to give us enough information so we can go down and arrest Mr. Buono, we have to make a deal. The deal is that he won't get the death penalty in the state of Washington, and that he will testify truthfully in Los Angeles in a trial, if and when we have a trial.
With Buono now in the frame, forensic teams searched his home and workshop. Astonishingly, they could not find a single fingerprint because of his obsessive cleanliness. However, they did find some evidence. They discovered the white polyester fiber on Judy Miller's eyelid matched upholstery material in Bono's workshop. They also found forensic evidence which placed another victim at his home.
In the chair in the living room where we've learned from Bianchi where the victims were originally placed, a fiber was found down inside the chair. And that fiber was connected to a fiber that was found in Lauren Wagner's fingers. That's pretty positive evidence that this girl was in Bono's house.
And that fiber evidence was extremely important evidence in this case.
As Bianchi had already pleaded guilty to 7 counts of murder as part of his deal, he did not face trial. His cousin, Angelo Buono, appeared in court on November the 16th, 1981. At the time, it was the longest trial in U.S. criminal history, with Michael Nash, the Deputy Attorney General, prosecuting.
The jury selection alone took almost 4 months. And then on top of that, Kenneth Bianchi was on the witness stand for about 6 months. The problem was that he changed his mind about everything. He did everything possible to sabotage that case against Angelo Buono.
But the ploy failed. After a mammoth trial lasting more than 2 years, in November 1983, Angelo Buono was found guilty on 9 counts of murder. He was acquitted on the 10th count, that of Yolanda Washington, as it was accepted that he had been driving the car whilst Bianchi strangled her in the back. Both cousins were later sentenced to life in prison.
Someone said, so how come you're not celebrating? And I said, you have all these dead girls. They had family and friends who are forever scarred by all this. This is tragedy.
But the brutal killers could no longer haunt the streets of L.A.
In September 2002, Buono dies at the age of 67 in jail. And Bianchi remained in jail in Washington State.
They're not the first serial killers, and they're not the last. But they were two of the worst human beings who've ever walked the face of the earth.
They are among the most horrifying killers you could encounter, because the rape, torture, and in the end, killing of utterly innocent young women for nothing but their own pleasure and their own gratification is unimaginably evil.
The two cousins reigned terror over the city of Los Angeles. They strangled and raped 10 females in just 4 months, including 4 girls. They electrocuted and gassed some of their victims and relished watching their slow, painful deaths. That makes Angelo Buono and Kenneth Bianchi two of the world's most evil killers. May the 22nd, 1997, Hammersmith, London. 46-year-old Traj Koneva cycled home to meet his 12-year-old daughter, Katerina. It was the first time the schoolgirl had ever been home alone.
Her father tried to phone her and she wasn't answering and he became quite worried, so he rushed back home. And when he arrived, he couldn't get into the house. He sees a pair of man's shoes underneath the door and this causes him concern because there's somebody in his home who shouldn't be there.
He starts to bang on the door with all his might. He shoves it, he kicks it, he cannot open it. Consumed by fear, he is horrified at what could be happening to his beloved daughter.
Realizing the intruder was escaping, Trage chased after him and came face to face with Andrzej Kunowski, an illegal immigrant from Poland. Trage didn't know it, but he was looking into the eyes of his daughter's murderer.
Kunowski was a cold-blooded criminal. He had no respect for human life. He had no respect for young girls. He had no respect for the law.
Katarina's father chased after Kunowski, but the callous killer fled. A European manhunt was already in force, searching for the fugitive, who was wanted for charges of sexual assaults and rapes on women and young girls in Poland.
Kunowski was known as the Beast. Seldom has a nickname been deserved more.
He was a prolific paedophile and sexual predator who attacked vulnerable victims for almost three decades and would go on to take the life of a 12-year-old girl. This makes Andrzej Kunowski one of the world's most evil killers. May the 22nd, 1997, Hammersmith, West London, England. The country was in shock when news broke that a 12-year-old schoolgirl had been brutally murdered in her own home. Katarina Koneva was followed home from school by a prolific sex offender and paedophile, 41-year-old Andrzej Kunowski.
She was beautiful, talented, promising, and to snuff out her life was an act of inconceivable brutality, a barbarity of the worst kind.
Kunowski was a wanted Polish national who'd entered the UK illegally less than 7 months before the brutal murder. He left his mark on senior investigating officer David Little.
Kunowski was actually probably one of the worst people I've ever dealt with in my time, mainly because he was so prolific.
The Met police worked tirelessly to identify Katarina's killer. In doing so, they would also bring to justice a criminal who was wanted for a string of heinous crimes in Poland. Journalist Szymon Werostek was a young boy at the time of Kunowski's crimes in Poland.
He still remembered in our town. He was a very dangerous criminal and an utterly depraved man. He had no regard for human life. People were there to satisfy his wild animalistic urges.
He had no remorse at all. There was nothing could stop him, basically, apart from being incarcerated.
This killer's story begins in Warsaw, Poland. Andrzej Mirosław Klembert was born on March the 29th, 1956. Warsaw had suffered heavily during the Second World War, and this post-war period was a difficult time for the country. Young Andrzej didn't have the easiest of childhoods.
His parents were petty criminals. At the age of two, he went to a foster home because both of his parents went to prison. His grandfather, we understand, was in a psychiatric ward for sexual offences as well.
He went into the institutional care system. And I think by the time he was returned to his mother, quite a lot of damage had been done.
After leaving prison, Andrzej's mother met and married builder Stefan Kunowski. Andrzej took his stepfather's surname and the family set up home in Mława, a small town 80 miles north of Warsaw. At first, family life appeared to be normal.
Konowski jako dziecko był raczej...
As a child, Konowski was quite short, a bit overweight. He was teased by his classmates and he struggled to fit in. I think this had an impact on his psyche.
He was a bit of a mummy's boy, but he had a ferocious temper and he used to respond to the taunts with explosions of anger and violence.
As well as a violent tendency, as he grew older, Konowski became fascinated with local girls, which unnerved those around him.
His mother begins to sense that there's something in the adolescent Konowski that is a little unusual. She was to say later that he developed an unhealthy appetite for sex, an unnatural sexual desire.
Age 13, he first came to the attention of the authorities for stealing.
Theft and those kind of property offences are all about a sense of entitlement. They are about wanting something and just going and taking it, regardless of the impact on others. So this is a very early warning sign for me.
As punishment, Konowski was sent to juvenile detention.
I think it would have been a bit of a learning experience for him, but not a positive one. I think he would have been learning from his peers who had also committed offences. I think he's becoming a slightly more skilled criminal in the time that he's there.
By the age of 17, Konowski had moved back into the family home, but soon reverted to his thieving ways and would steal money from his mother. His disturbing preoccupation with local girls had also continued.
Few people knew what the monster in their neighbourhood was hiding. Some women said there was something strange in his eyes.
He was the sort of boy that a girl would probably not look at twice. But at the age of 17, he clearly felt some kind of profound sexual urge and decides to attack a neighbour's 16-year-old daughter. He drags her into the bushes and rapes her.
This is a very early age to be committing this kind of offence, and it's very important that we realise that you don't go from a healthy individual one day with normal psychological functioning to a rapist the next. There would have been an escalation of behaviour.
The 16-year-old victim was able to identify her neighbour, Konowski, as her rapist. Two other local girls also came forward, having been attacked in similar circumstances. And one of these was added to the indictment against Konowski. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. It would be the first rape conviction of many.
In 1976, he's released from prison. He's now 20. He's spruced himself up a bit, given to dressing quite well.
He also earned the nickname of the Little Doctor, which involved his rather exaggerated habit of clicking his heels and slightly bowing whenever he met someone.
But don't let anyone be fooled by that. This is a man who has nothing in mind but rape. Within a month, he commits the next attack. This time, it's a 24-year-old woman.
Konowski was apprehended and returned to prison for another 9 months for the rape. However, it was only a temporary respite for the community.
He was only sentenced to 9 months imprisonment. A young man who's already served 3 years in prison for rape. Was that not taken into account? Was there no suggestion that perhaps we have the beginnings of a serial rapist on our hands?
Once again, prison time didn't curb the devious sexual desires in Konowski. Instead, it only seemed to ignite them, and the 22-year-old went on to attack more women and young girls in the area.
In 1978, he committed rapes in June, July, August, September, October, and November. Sometimes, on one occasion, up to 4 rapes in a month. He was totally prolific and probably felt he was untouchable.
Konowski would typically attack a woman and then choke her. He had a specific method to lure his victims in. First, he would call out to a woman from his car. And as she'd approach him and lean in, he would wind up the window, trapping her. He would then approach her from behind and very brutally rape her. His victims were extremely intimidated and later couldn't remember his face, which shows just how brutal and how aggressive this monster, the Beast from Mojave, was.
By the end of 1978, Kunovsky had brutally attacked at least 24 victims. On the 22nd of December, he forced a girl into a cellar, holding a razor to her ear before raping her. She was just 11 years old.
Kunovsky's record is one of escalation. As he grows older, with more experience of how he can get away with these attacks and the better opportunities he can spot for these attacks. And it also reflects his mounting lust. It's an escalating graph of him getting more and more and more dangerous.
In January 1979, his reign of terror halted when authorities convicted Kunovsky for some of the rapes he'd committed during the previous year. But being behind bars in a male prison still didn't stop him offending.
He was a very prolific sex offender. He had also raped his cellmate in prison. He had no remorse whatsoever.
In April 1979, Kunovsky was almost 3 months into a sentence at Warszawa Wola Detention Prison, Poland, for a series of brutal rapes on young girls and women. Bored of prison life, Kunovsky didn't intend to stay behind bars. He was planning a great escape.
Kunovsky's in prison and decides that he wishes not to be and soars through the bars of his cell to get out. It almost defies belief. I mean, here is a serial rapist who seems to be able to escape at will. Needless to say, no sooner has he done so than he rapes again.
On the 8th of May 1979, police intercepted him 85 miles away in the city of Łódź. Desperate to avoid rearrest, Kunovsky took a young girl hostage with an axe. After a tense standoff, police succeeded in bringing him back into custody. And after 3 months, he was transferred to a psychiatric hospital in Pyrzyszków. But once again, he managed to free himself.
He soars through the bars of the psychiatric hospital and breaks out.
Kunovsky stole two cars and fled across the country, but he was eventually pursued by the police and crashed one of the stolen cars into a house near Jawdów. He was immediately arrested and taken back into custody on the morning of August the 24th, 1979. There he awaited trial.
Prison is just a bit of a revolving door for him at this point in his life. When he's spending time in prison, he's learning from other people, he's ruminating, he's fantasizing, he's planning his next attack, because that's all that matters to him.
Authorities took a tougher stance in 1980 when Kunovsky was faced with over 70 charges, predominantly for sex offenses and rape against women and children. The litany of charges also included escape from a police convoy and attempted murder.
Finally, his crimes catch up with him and he's effectively sentenced to 15 years imprisonment.
On hearing the verdict, the prosecutor, Waldemar Smarzewski, said he'd hoped to separate Kunovsky from society for longer, as he was certain he would go on to rape again, perhaps even start killing. 5 years later, an additional 15 years were added in recognition of the brutality Kunovsky had shown to one of his young victims. Kunovsky was now facing 30 years behind bars.
At this point in Poland's history, their prisons are massively overcrowded. The actual conditions in these prisons would have been absolutely horrendous.
Kunovsky was desperate to get out and wrote to the Polish authorities.
He claimed that his cellmates treated him badly, that they humiliated him psychologically and physically, that he was beaten. At some point, his teeth got knocked out. Kunovsky complains that he had his throat slit.
While Kunovsky's letters had no effect, a momentous announcement by the Polish Parliament in 1989 would have a significant impact on the 33-year-old's future. to mark the end of communism, an Amnesty Act was passed, which resulted in the reduction of prison sentences. Konovsky used this to his advantage. On the 17th of January 1990, the court in Olsztyn delivered a decision allowing him to be considered for parole. He walked free the following year after demonstrating good behavior.
There was an absolute failure on the part of the Polish criminal justice system because he was a serial offender. And when somebody is constantly making that decision time and time again to harm other people, they're not going to simply decide to stop one day.
Despite his criminal background, Konovsky's family were keen to help their son get back on his feet.
With the help of his family, he bought himself a delivery van. And he was living in a flat which his parents bought him on Tuwima Street in Mława. Konovsky started trading at the local market. There he met a woman who would become his future partner. What the woman has in common with his victims is a considerable age difference. She was 10 years his junior. They would go on to have a daughter together.
However, despite setting up home with his partner and her six-year-old son, Konovsky still couldn't contain his devious and aggressive behavior and continued to prey upon vulnerable women without his partner's knowledge. She soon became aware of his violent tendencies.
Eventually, he attacks her, and also, for good measure, he attacks her son. Trying to be someone conventional and respectable simply doesn't suit Konovsky's character. Underneath that polished exterior is a poisonous toad of a little man who thinks nothing of destroying women and any woman he may come across.
The relationship broke down and Konovsky's partner left him. She would soon discover she was pregnant and vowed to protect the child, a baby girl, from him. Meanwhile, Konovsky had become obsessed with a new type of victim, so-called latchkey children.
At this point in his offending history, he begins to target young girls who are home alone, latchkey children. Their mum, their dad might be out at work and they are in the house on their own. Now, this is really significant for me because he's starting to engage in some kind of stalking behaviour. So this does suggest to me that his offending is becoming more sophisticated and he's becoming a lot more dangerous.
Soon, reports of school children being attacked spread in and around the county of Mława and as far away as Warsaw. Parents were terrified of leaving their children alone.
At the time, I was in primary school. My classmates and I were accompanied to the nearby school by our parents or grandparents. Where we were allowed to go was restricted. At that time, I didn't know his name. I just knew that he was an older man. We were told that if we saw a man acting strange, we should scream and go straight home.
In 1992, Konovsky continued to prey on vulnerable children in both Mława and Warsaw. Despite being arrested several times, by 1995, he was free to resume his attacks on young girls, targeting an 11-year-old in February and abducting another in March. On May the 16th that year, he struck again.
Konovsky is on the streets of Warsaw and once again targets a young girl coming back from school. He watches her, sees that she lets herself in to her flat with a latchkey. There doesn't appear to be anyone in except her. He knocks on the door, forces his way in, and then engages her in a conversation, which is bizarre to say the least, in which, "Can you keep a secret?" he says to her. She's obviously slightly bewildered by all this. And then he asks her to kiss him. And then, of course, he starts to suffocate her. He pulls her blouse over her head, and he attacks her.
Kunowski then fled the scene, and the 10-year-old girl bravely raised the alarm.
She shouts, screams after him, and he is, in fact, caught.
Linking other similar crimes in the area, the police were able to put Kunowski on trial. The primary charge was rape of an 11-year-old girl. There was great interest from the local media.
Journalists named Kunowski the Beast from Mwawa, a very appropriate description when it comes to Kunowski.
It seemed that justice would finally be served. However, there was to be a twist of fate.
Kunowski pulls one of the great stunts. He persuades the prison authorities that he's got a very sore left hip and that it very badly inhibits his movement. It is complete and utter balderdash. But nevertheless, the little doctor is quite convincing.
In June 1996, he was actually released from prison on 3 months' parole in order to get a hip operation, and he was left free to go and sort it out for himself.
The man named the Beast never did have his operation. Instead, he embarked on a 1,000-mile trip. He was London-bound.
I think Kunowski reaches the point where he realises he needs a blank slate. So I think there is that urge in him to start somewhere else and to start looking for a new victim pool.
In his last years in Poland, the press had taken to giving him a nickname, the Beast. Well, the Beast had arrived in England, and it was only a matter of time before he would strike again.
He arrived in October 1996 at Victoria Station. From that moment on, he just disappeared into the UK. As an illegal immigrant, he was totally below the radar, and because of that, his DNA was not taken, his fingerprints were not taken. We had no knowledge of who Kunowski was.
At that time, there was tens of thousands of European people arriving. It was impossible for the authorities to keep track of this, and very easy for Kunowski to disappear into the subculture of London, where jobs are paid cash in hand, where rent is paid cash in hand, and no questions are asked.
The fact that he is an illegal immigrant with a disgusting record of crime in his native Poland is known to no one.
It's difficult to imagine Kunowski could even have stood out in the crowd. He was just an everyday bloke in the street. And in the accommodation in which he flitted between in various bedsits and flats, people were coming and going. It was a perfect cover for him to get up to what he wanted to do and to resume his attacks on women.
Just 7 months after arriving in the UK, Kunowski's perverse desire for attacking children was once again ignited. He was on the prowl for another victim, and the 41-year-old reverted to a familiar MO, following so-called latchkey children home from school in the knowledge that they would be alone. And it wasn't long before he struck again.
Kunowski had spotted Katerina Kaneva. I suspect that he did his homework and that he knew that she left school and would arrive back at her flat in Hammersmith.
Katerina was a 12-year-old girl who had come over from Macedonia with both of her parents, Traj and Jackie, and her younger brother. She was studying at Holland Park School. She was well-liked. She was a bubbly young girl. Her family were here to learn English and to escape from Macedonia, effectively. They wanted a better life.
On May the 22nd, 1997, as Katerina made her way home from school, she couldn't know she was being followed.
This is very similar to the offence that we know of in Poland. So this would have been planned because this would have involved some kind of stalking. And I've heard stalking described as murder in slow motion, and that's exactly what it is in this case.
When the 12-year-old arrived at her flat, Kunowski was close behind. In a twist of fate, this was the first time Katerina had ever been home alone.
Her dad should have been at home, but unfortunately he was delayed at his English lessons, and so he was late. Katerina went home from school as normal. let herself in, and we assume that Karnofsky knocked on her door. There was no sign of forced entry at all, and the door was locked internally after he'd entered the house.
I think she would have opened the door. She was a trusting young girl. What she was doing, however, was letting in a monster. He takes her into the living room of the flat and barricades the door with a chair.
From that moment inside the flat, what happened between killer and victim, only the killer knows. But he clearly had grabbed her and began to choke her with a cord he found to hand, pushing her down and choking her at the same time as he attacked her. She must have been screaming, but in a flat at that time of the day, no one could hear it.
At some point, Katerina's father, Traj, had returned home, but the door was locked from the inside and Katerina did not answer. Becoming concerned, Traj looked through the letterbox.
He saw Katerina lying on the floor. He then saw beneath the door, basically what he described as two black shoes. He then obviously realised that something was wrong.
He's horrified. He starts to bang on the door with all his might. He shoves it, he kicks it, he cannot open it. Consumed by fear, he is horrified at what could be happening to his beloved daughter.
Whilst that was happening, he became aware that the person inside had moved to the front of the house, effectively, and naturally assumed that the person was leaving by the first-floor window. So he ran downstairs and out to the front and saw Karnofsky actually coming out of the window and land in the front garden. He then confronted Karnofsky, who just basically stared at him.
Getting his first look at the intruder, Traj noticed a spot of blood on his face. As Karnofsky fled the scene, Traj had only a split second to plan his next move. His instinct was to chase after him.
As they went down the street, Karnofsky turned and shouted to passers-by, "Help me, help me." And two workmen could see that something was happening here and decided to intervene.
He's actually making out that he's the victim, that somebody's after him, and passers-by in the street basically help him.
The well-meaning members of the public held Traj back, allowing Karnofsky to get a head start. Traj managed to break free and continued the pursuit. The chase came to an abrupt halt when Karnofsky pulled out a knife. Surrendering, Traj rushed back to check on his daughter.
After Karnofsky had run away from Traj, he wanted to get away from the scene of crime as fast as he possibly could. He was a young lady driving her car down the street at the time. He stopped in front of her and threatened her with a knife and made her get out of her car.
He sped off in the hijacked vehicle before abandoning it half a mile away on Shepherd's Bush Road. He then boarded a bus destined for Hammersmith Broadway.
He gets off the bus and disappears into the crowd, once again in the wind, beneath the radar.
With Karnofsky on the run, Traj had made it back to his flat. The scene behind the door would devastate his family's life forever.
When he came back, he had to break the door down to get in, past the barricades that Karnofsky had across the door, and there found his daughter with this cord so tight around her neck, lying on the floor. He was trying desperately to pull at this cord and he couldn't manage it, so he went to the kitchen to get a kitchen knife to try and cut it open.
He was screaming for help, obviously, and one of the neighbours went to help him. Police were called.
And by the time they arrived, he was desperately trying to revive her. Paramedics took over, but without any success.
Katerina had been murdered. The cause of the 12-year-old's death was strangulation. The police needed to act fast to find the culprit.
Most killings happen in a domestic scene, and often it's the last person or the person there who turns out to be the killer.
Unfortunately, Traj has to be considered as a suspect and was being questioned as such.
The first time his wife finds him, he is a prisoner. Her daughter is dead, and her husband is accused of killing her. The impact on her must have been devastating.
With no witnesses to the murder itself, police appeal to the local community for information. Seven people would come forward, having witnessed the chase, but their evidence had flaws. A number of the witnesses had assumed that Kunovsky was actually a victim being chased, and so descriptions of him became muddled with descriptions of Trage. The police were no closer to catching the actual killer. Whilst police artists worked to produce a composite sketch of the man seen running away, detectives had a stroke of luck when a local builder's yard checked their security camera.
There is CCTV evidence of the two running past an alleyway, first Kunovsky and then obviously being chased by Trage.
The CCTV proved Trage's claims that he had chased an intruder away from his home. At the murder scene, forensic teams found two significant clues.
One was a fingerprint on the windowsill, which did not belong to any member of the family. The other was a single hair on a cardigan of Katerina's.
But there was one major obstacle.
Kronowski's fingerprints weren't on file anywhere in Britain. And so any conventional method of trying to find the offender using either fingerprints or DNA wasn't available. Kunovsky was a ghost.
Detectives working to create a profile of the murderer couldn't begin to guess the true depravity of this killer or how widespread his crimes were.
It was inevitable that Kunovsky was going to kill because he enjoyed the feelings of power. He felt that he was entitled to do what he wanted with his victims.
Once again, Kunovsky was at large. The killer moved towards the West Midlands, seeking employment in fruit farms. But he soon went back to his thieving ways.
It wasn't long before he had his fingers in the till and he was arrested for stealing from his employer. He clearly thought he was bulletproof.
When police examined Kunovsky's forged passport, they discovered his visa had expired and he was detained in Oxfordshire on immigration offences. The murder of Katerina 1 month earlier still remained unsolved. And whilst forensic evidence had been taken from the murder scene, there was no match on the national DNA database. Immigration officials didn't know they had a killer in custody, and the killer had no intention of waiting to be caught.
Had the law at that time allowed the immigration authorities to take a DNA sample from someone they suspected was an illegal immigrant, they would have been able to say to the police in Hammersmith that the man they had in their custody was actually the man who had murdered Katerina.
Unaware that they had a killer in custody, immigration authorities granted Kunovsky temporary release whilst his case was being considered.
He was in need of a new identity. So when he was released from the detention centre, he managed to procure a fake Portuguese passport. And of course, again, it put another distance between himself and his criminal past.
In September 1997, Kunovsky's application was turned down and he appealed. The serial escapee had no intention of returning for his immigration hearing. By the time the appeal was rejected in December 1997, he had disappeared. He would live life under the radar for the next 4 years.
I have no idea where he was for those years. He was using aliases. He may have been arrested and dealt with under another name somewhere else, totally different. But I find it inconceivable that he's not committed other offences.
In 2001, 4 years after the brutal killing of Katerina, Kunovsky had made his way back to West London.
Kunovsky's brass neck knew no bounds. He even registers with the NHS under his assumed name of De Diaz for a heart bypass operation. It's breathtaking audacity.
The following year, after a period of recuperation, the beast was fighting fit and back on the streets of West London.
Now he's living in a room in Acton. working part-time as a tailor, little odd jobs here and there. And yet again, targeting vulnerable young women. At one point, he's hovering outside Ealing Broadway Underground Station, and he spies a young Korean woman, 21, looking at a board which has advertisements for rooms to let.
He went up to her, offered her assistance, told her that he would help her find somewhere to live. She'd not long been in the country and her English was actually very stilted. So he offered to take her back to where he was staying, his bedsit, and help her find accommodation.
When Kinoski decided to lure this student back to his flat, I think there was an intention to kill because he'd killed before. I think he'd enjoyed killing before. He'd gotten away with it before. So I think there was a real arrogance in him at this point in time.
Once he got her to a bedsit, he overpowered her, tied her up, and raped her.
Kinoski was now at the height of his brutality as an experienced sexual predator and brutal in his aggression against women. And he attacked this Korean student with a frenzy.
To actually be taken, tied up in somebody else's home and then raped is a horrendous ordeal. She was estranged to the country. She'd not long been in this country. She thought she'd been befriended by somebody who was going to help her. He abused that trust. He abused her.
During the three-hour ordeal, the defenceless student's survival instincts kicked in.
This young woman, she was very smart. She was able to basically talk her way out of it. But she was able to say to him, well, it's OK, I'll call you tomorrow, or I want to see you again. So she was appealing to a kind of inherent narcissism within him, and it saved her life. It was an incredibly brave thing to do.
Kinoski, in his vanity and arrogance, thought that would be all right and that she would actually phone him the following day. The young Korean woman goes straight to the police. For the first time, Kinoski's made a real blunder.
By committing the offence in his own flat, Kinoski had effectively led police to his front door. However, the police still had no idea this was Katerina's killer. In May 2003, he was convicted of the rape and received 9 years imprisonment at HMP Belmarsh. When officials took Kinoski's DNA, it sparked some interesting developments.
A number of things have happened. His DNA is on file. His fingerprints are on file. The review of Katerina's killing is initiated. And lo and behold, the DNA matches.
The most damning DNA evidence was the DNA on the hair on Katerina's cardigan and also a fingerprint as Kinoski jumped out of the window. Both of those are irrefutable, absolute pieces of evidence.
When Met found that they had not just a rapist, but a significant murderer in a case that hadn't been able to solve for 6 years. They then checked international files, and suddenly it flashed up to the astonishment of the London detectives that Kinoski had this massive record for two decades of attacks in Poland.
The Polish authorities were very helpful with their assistance, and the DNA proved that he'd committed offences in Poland as well.
The trial for the murder of Katerina Konewa began at the Old Bailey in March 2004. Both senior investigating officer David Little and court correspondent Paul Cheston witnessed the proceedings.
It was a very emotional trial because the family, both Traj and Jackie, were obviously very upset at what had happened.
Tragedy of on this nature, particularly violent murder in a family, often has the most destructive effect. They almost turned on themselves in a way, and Katerina's mother and father split up.
Unfortunately, in every case where a child or anybody has been murdered, the family assume a degree of guilt, absolutely incorrectly. Traj expected to be home before he was. Jackie expected Traj to be home for their daughter arriving home. Between the two of them, they both harboured a degree of guilt for what had happened.
Traj was face to face with his daughter's killer once again. But this time he had to give evidence of that fateful day and the heartbreaking decision he made.
The moment that had the most impact on me was just how he explained how he stumbled across this attack on his own daughter in his own flat and was confronted with a two-horned dilemma of chase the attacker or tend to his stricken daughter. And that was explained in his own words through a whole veil of tears in his eyes and choking in his throat. It was heartrending evidence from the witness box.
The heartless killer, Kunovsky, appeared unmoved.
When Kunovsky was in the dock at court, he showed no remorse. He just stayed there, listened to the evidence totally, without any emotion whatsoever.
It took the jury of four women and eight men less than 3 hours to decide. Kunovsky was found guilty of Katerina's murder and sentenced to life imprisonment by the Common Sergeant of London, Judge Peter Beaumont, QC.
Sentencing Kunovsky for the murder of Katerina, the judge said, and I quote, "You took the life of a child who was just beginning to enjoy what this country had to offer. It was a life of great promise, and you ended it in circumstances of great violence and terror."
Kunovsky's sentence was bittersweet for Katerina's parents.
They'd lost their daughter, a 12-year-old girl. At the time of the conviction, Trage felt there was closure and it had been dealt with. Jackie didn't. She felt cheated. She just felt that nothing could be done to make amends for what he'd done.
Whilst Kunovsky began his sentence at HMP Frankland, Europe's media descended on the small village of Mława.
In Poland, Kunovsky's mother is naturally approached by the media, and she confesses that she never thought he was entirely normal, but refuses to accept that he actually is a monster.
Kunovsky wasn't in prison for long. 5 years into his life sentence, he died of heart failure in the Durham prison, age 53.
When we discovered that Kunovsky had died in prison, the first thing we did was to go and tell the families. And I do know that Jackie felt cheated by his death. She wanted him to burn in hell, as she said. She did feel that he'd got the easy way out.
Even after his death, countless victims are still living a life sentence imposed by him.
This kind of experience had an impact on these people. It changed their life and behaviour entirely.
He continually offended whilst he was at large, and I am certain that he must have committed other offences.
We cannot know how dangerous Kunovsky was. This was literally a predator on the loose. He could have committed literally hundreds of attacks, and we shall never, ever know for sure.
He was a prolific sex offender and paedophile who caused torment and fear across Europe for almost three decades before taking the life of a bright young girl who had her whole future ahead of her. He showed no remorse for any of his actions, and that's what makes Andrei Kunovsky one of the world's most evil killers.